Humans are resilient and can live in all sorts of crazy places. For example, I live in a windowless padded room with nothing but a microphone, the internet, and a bottle. Don't ask what I use that last one for. Still, as bizarre as my home is, some are even crazier. From minuscule islands to cities literally brimming with garbage, let's explore some of the strangest places people actually live.
You're listening to
Be Amazed. The first time you hear about Menchiagneser, it might sound like a dream. Situated in sunny Cairo, Egypt, Menchiagneser has a low unemployment, extremely cheap housing, and a populace that self-describes as generally happy. The only problem? The city is permanently buried in garbage. Well, you can't have it all, I guess. Garbage bags, broken bottles, tattered newspaper, discarded plywood, tin cans, wrappers, all humanity's grime flows freely through Menchiagneser. The reason this garbage city exists is that Cairo, despite being a major city with a population of 20 million people, never invested in an advanced waste management system. Because of this, it fell to individual citizens to dispose of their trash. As the city grew larger, however, residents began to run out of places to dump their waste. Menchiagneser eventually became the unofficial dumping ground for the city's trash, and the people living there took up the mantle. It's not uncommon for residents of Menchiagneser to go door to door in Cairo collecting trash, which they then bring back to their own homes. This has led to their nickname, the Zebalim, which translates to the trash people. The Zebalim sort through the garbage in order to recycle the glass, reuse the plastic, and collect various other pieces of trash to repurpose. Despite the unglamorous work, the Zebalim are efficient, apparently recycling up to 85% of the garbage they sort. If true, this makes them more than four times as efficient as conventional waste management companies. Unsurprisingly though, illness and poor living conditions are common here, and the Zebalim make up some of the poorest people in Cairo. This makes moving out difficult. If you're born here, the idea of looking out your window and seeing anything besides trash might feel like an unattainable dream. Treat your garbage men with respect, everyone. Have you ever wanted to live on a desert island but just hate sand? Well, allow me to introduce you to the Principality of Sealand. Majestic, huh? It's basically a metal platform off the eastern coast of the United Kingdom, consisting of just 1 acre of surface area, or 0.0015 square miles. The platform, formerly known as Fort Ruffs, is one of several constructed during World War II by the British for defensive purposes, but was decommissioned in 1956 when it was no longer useful. Several years later in 1967, the platform was commandeered by Paddy Roy Bates, a former major in the British Royal Army. Bates then declared the Principality of Sealand independent from the United Kingdom. If taken seriously, Sealand is the smallest nation in the world by a wide margin. Currently, Vatican City is the smallest country, consisting of just 110 acres, but that's still 110 times bigger than Sealand. I said if taken seriously because, well, Sealand's independence isn't actually recognized by any nation on Earth. Right now, only Prince Michael Bates, son of Roy, and his wife call Sealand home, though they admit to spending most of their time in more traditional nations. And I mean, who could blame them? Their home country is smaller than a football field. While Sealand is open to visitors, you need to be lifted aboard via a pulley, and the interior of the fort is pretty modest. Despite its minuscule size and population, Sealand has many things you'd expect from a real nation. A coat of arms, a tourism board, its own currency of the Sealand dollar, and even passports, which again, aren't recognized by any nation on Earth. Sealand even has its own political turmoil. When back in 1978, a band of mercenaries attempted to seize Sealand, but were fought off by the Bates family. Yeah, really. When the invaders were captured, a German diplomat was sent to Sealand to negotiate their release. Patty Bates delightedly considered this a de facto admittance that Zealand was in fact a real country. What do you think? Is Zealand a real country, or just a massive chunk of metal in the ocean? Are you ready for some houses that rock? Please enjoy these next few moments before you realize just how lazy that pun was. Let's explore the town of Coober Pedy in Australia. Half of Coober Pedy's population of 2,500 live underground. Houses, shops, and even churches have been slowly dug into the surrounding sandstone bedrock. But how did the people of Coober Pedy become real-life mole men? Well, it's surprisingly simple. Over 100 years ago, Coober Pedy began life as a mining town. The land there has a mineral-rich bedrock that's full of opals, which miners flocked to trying to make their fortune. Sometimes when they found a particularly opal-dense chunk of rock, they would start sleeping and eating near it to make sure no one else claimed their territory. Over the years, and the further down they dug, this slowly led to the rocky underground society you see today. While opals have dried up a little in recent years, the town still produces the occasional beautiful gemstone. There's another reason living underground suits the people of Coober Pedy, though, and that's the weather. Coober Pedy can get up to 113 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer and drop to just 33 in the winter. Underground, temperatures are much easier to regulate. This is because while the surface of the Earth is subject to weather and the day and night cycle, the deeper down you go, the less interference there is with the ground's natural temperature. In Coober Pedy, underground homes have a nice predictable temperature of around 72 degrees. Ventilation shafts allow these subterranean dwellings a steady stream of fresh air too, preventing them from running out of oxygen or getting too stuffy. Residents of Coober Pedy by and large design their own homes. If you've got the energy and time to carve yourself out a new guest room, there's nothing stopping you from doing it. According to locals, however, this has led to several instances where enterprising residents accidentally dug into their neighbor's home. Man, I get anxiety just asking my neighbors to turn their TV down. Imagine digging a tunnel into their bedroom. Sometimes I get tired of the hustle and bustle of modern living and just want to escape. I need somewhere remote, somewhere quiet, somewhere isolated. And I think I found the perfect place. I'd like to introduce you to Elliday Island. Sorry, that's Elliday Island. My Icelandic is a little rusty. Anyway, this minuscule scenic island is the most northeastern landmass found in the Westman Archipelago, which consists of 18 islands off the Icelandic coast. The entire island measures in at just 110 acres, meaning it's about the same size as the previously mentioned smallest recognized nation on Earth, Vatican City. Despite all this space, Elliday Island is home to one single solitary residence, which some have dubbed the loneliest house in the world. Dramatic name aside, the domicile is not actually a permanent dwelling. Also, it wasn't built by a billionaire as a zombie apocalypse safe house. It isn't the vacation home of musician Bjork or any other wacky internet rumor you might have heard. The truth of the lonely house is that it was constructed in 1953 by a local hunting association as temporary housing for hunters. The island is home to puffins, which, because they're not a protected bird in Iceland, are hunted for their coats, meat, and even oil. Not sure how appealing a puffin burger sounds. Before the era of this lonely hunter's lodge, however, Elliday was home to five entire families. These families survived by fishing and raising cattle, but the last of them left the island in the 1930s. While the lodge has no permanent residence, it still contains many rooms and can be rented on a nightly basis. You'll have to figure out how to actually get there, though, along with finding anything to do once you are. You can always start puffin hunting, if you're a monster, that is. Can you imagine having a bedroom that's the same size as a casket? Well, welcome to the nightmare that is living in one of Hong Kong's shoebox apartments. These are subdivided housing units taken to the extreme, where dozens of people live in a single room. Each tiny apartment can be as small as 15 square feet. That's a tenth of a standard parking space. Even Hong Kong's prisoners live in roomier cells in Stanley Prison, Prisoners live in 80 square foot cells, five times the size of some shoebox apartments. Oh, and they're packed together, too. Floors as small as 400 square feet, about the size of a regular two-bed apartment in New York, can house up to 18 people. This means these apartments often extend only as far as a mattress, which explains why they're sometimes called coffin apartments. To live this way, residents of these minuscule apartments must store their belongings on hooks or shelves, sometimes dangling from another bed above their heads. In some shoeboxes, tenants might be lucky enough to have walls between their units. Some only have a wire mesh like dog crates. But what led to these awful creations? Well, in Hong Kong, real estate is a precious commodity. This is because only one quarter of Hong Kong is considered fit for development. This means there is a huge demand for property, and the people who own property in Hong Kong have realized that splitting it up into tiny chunks then renting it out is very profitable. After all, why charge one family for one apartment when you could charge 12 people to live in the same space? And speaking of cost, you might think that units this tiny would come cheap. However, even a shoebox apartment can cost 1,300 Hong Kong dollars per month. While that only equates to around 166 US dollars, keep in mind that the minimum wage in Hong Kong is roughly $765. So almost a fifth of their earnings go on renting these super small spaces. As of 2023, there are some 220,000 residents living in subdivided housing like this. The Hong Kong government has declared that it intends to make housing a priority and end shoebox homes by 2049. So just enough time for two more generations of kids to grow up in them. Great. It may surprise you to learn I'm an avid rock climber. Yeah, turns out years of playing World of Warcraft and surfing the web have actually given me pretty incredible grip strength. Still, even with my impressive skills, I can't imagine living in our next location, the Hanging Temple of Hengshan in Shaanxi, China. It is basically an enormous temple clinging to the edge of a cliff face, approximately 246 feet above the ground. The structure is held aloft by hundreds of bars and poles that have been dug into the side of the cliff. Winding passages carved into the rock itself lead to different rooms and areas of the temple structure. This is both a stylistic and functional design decision. The height of the temple protects it from flooding, while the cave-like interior protects it from harsh wind and sunlight. The exterior of the temple is mostly wooden with some stonework. These rudimentary materials, along with general signs of aging, place its construction somewhere between 386 and 534 CE, and is said to have been built by one lone monk named Lao Ran. If that's true, just imagine that dude's upper body strength. Interestingly, rather than being dedicated to a single faith, three separate religions are represented within the temple: Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism. It's unclear whether the temple was originally constructed to be multi-denominational, or whether it changed to accommodate additional faiths over time. Even today, monks of each faith call the temple home and practice their beliefs there. The temple was in a state of disrepair for centuries. However, in 1900, a collective effort was made on behalf of the Chinese people to restore it to its former glory, which is why it's open to visitors today. Imagine convincing a group of people to spend their time and money restoring an ancient Chinese temple. I can't even get my roommates to pitch in for pizza. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. Life is a journey, and honestly, some days just feel a lot heavier than others. Whether it's something specific keeping you up at night or just a general sense of feeling overwhelmed, it's so easy to fall into the trap of thinking you have to figure every single thing out on your own. But no one has all the answers, and the truth is, no journey should be walked alone. Since May is Mental Health Awareness Month, it's the perfect time to check in with yourself. If you've been feeling stuck or anxious lately, I want you to know those feelings are more common than we think, and having someone with you to actually listen and support you can make all the difference. That's where BetterHelp comes in. They have over 30,000 fully licensed therapists who work under a strict code of conduct. They've served over 6 million people globally and really prioritize getting the match right for your specific needs.
If you aren't happy with your therapist, you can switch at any time. You don't have to be on this journey alone. Find support and have someone with you in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
If you don't get out much, sometimes the building you live in can feel like the whole world. Well, imagine how the residents of Whittier, Alaska must feel, because their entire city is located inside a single building. This unusual town began life as a large U.S. naval base in the 1950s, but was abandoned in 1966 when it was no longer strategically useful. In the years that followed that abandonment, Whittier slowly transformed into its own living ecosystem as people moved in. It was purchased by residents in 1973 and today has a population of approximately 214 people. The 14-story, single-roof town has everything you could want from your local community, including general stores, a postal service, a hospital, a church, a laundromat, and even a hotel. The school is in a separate building across from the main residence and is connected via an underground tunnel. While this may seem like a cruel way to deprive Whittier kids of fresh air, it's actually for their protection. Outside, Whittier can drop to just 24.8 degrees Fahrenheit in the winter. Guess you have to make the choice between your hair being stuffy or freezing. If residents wanted, they could move into the nearby Buckner building, but considering it's been abandoned since 1966, I imagine it's a lot less homey than what they're working with now. Some folks even say it's haunted, but I, a reputable information monger, would never claim that. If you want to visit, you're in for a real journey, though. The only way to reach Whittier is through a one-lane, one-track tunnel dug into the surrounding rock formation, which is over 13,000 feet long. By day, it's a road, and by night, it's closed off to allow trains through. On top of that, the nearest other town to Whittier is Anchorage, which is a 63-mile journey along the Seward Highway. While that may sound like a pain, it's a journey the general store proprietors need to make every week to keep their shops supplied. Suddenly, my 20-minute McDonald's run doesn't seem so bad. Located off the coast of Columbia, you'll find a tiny, beautiful, and cramped little getaway. Santa Cruz del Elote is one of the world's most densely packed islands, with a population of approximately 600 people spread throughout just 2.5 acres of land. For reference, the entire island could fit inside London's Trafalgar Square, and they'd still have room for a few of those giant lion statues. At a moderate pace, walking from one end of the island to the other takes just 2 minutes. Despite being a tight fit, life on the island sounds pretty nice. The residents have elected to have no police force dealing with crime as a community on the rare instances it occurs. Everyone is incredibly close-knit, gathering every Wednesday for music and dancing in the town square. One major problem you may have clocked, however, is the island's lack of access to fresh water. They are in the middle of the ocean, after all. This means the townsfolk are reliant on a single seller of bottled water who has a monopoly on the basic human necessity. Furthermore, industry and jobs are fairly limited on the island, so if you have big dreams, you're gonna have to leave eventually. Another more macabre way to escape the island is, dying. The island is so small there's no room for a graveyard, so many bodies are shipped over the water to be buried elsewhere. Now that's what you call the burial at sea. Another tiny, densely populated island is that of Mingingo in Lake Victoria, Kenya. According to Ugandan police, Mingingo Island houses around 500 people, which doesn't sound so bad, until you realize they're working with only 0.5 acre of land, about the size of 4 basketball courts. Being situated in a lake, the residents of Mingingo don't have to worry about access to fresh water, but do have to worry about political turmoil. You see, while Mingingo might be tiny, it makes for an excellent port and has unique access to Lake Victoria's fish. This has led both Uganda and Kenya to claim ownership of Mingingo, with both countries attempting to tax its poor residents. For now, the island is officially Kenyan, but if I lived there, I'd find this whole situation claustrophobic in more ways than one. Next up, about 62 miles south of Tokyo, Japan, in a not-at-all-ominous region of the ocean called the Devil's Sea, you'll find the small island of Miyake-jima. It enjoys idyllic scenery, quiet beaches, a close-knit community of around 3,000 people, and deadly toxic gases oozing out of the earth. Sounds lovely. The locals are always wearing some creepy masks, so do you want to know why? Well, Miyakijima just so happens to be located near a stratovolcano. These volcanoes are serious business. Vesuvius and Krakatoa, which were responsible for two of the most devastating eruptions in history, were also stratovolcanoes. Nearby Mount Oyama periodically releases enormous concentrations of sulfur dioxide. This gas is heavier than air, and while small amounts can be tolerated to a degree, prolonged exposure leads to asphyxiation. Following a particularly volatile eruption in the year 2000, around 3,600 residents, which was most of the island's population at the time, evacuated. But then, 5 years later, some decided to return. In fact, of the 3,600 evacuated residents, nearly 2,800 decided to go back to the Poison Volcano Island and the Devil's Sea. Talk about stubborn. As the island's gassy nature is so unpredictable and dangerous, residents of Miyakijima are required to carry gas masks with them at all times, and yes, I mean at all times. Whenever there's even a whiff of something stanky in the air, warning sirens start blaring all over the island. Residents then don their masks and carry on with their lives. What, you think the world is gonna grind to a halt just because of some deadly toxic gas? Residents of the island live relatively normal lives, farming, going to school, getting married. They just need to mask up from time to time. If you want to visit the island, you'll need to buy a gas mask too, and it's advised you take a respiratory medical exam prior to your arrival just to make sure your lungs can take it. Considering just eating smoky barbecue sauce makes me wheeze, I think I'm gonna have to pass. Have you ever gotten to work only to find the elevator's out and you have to climb 4 whole floors to get to the office? I still have nightmares. Well, it's a good thing I don't work at Feng Xing Shan. I'm getting a nosebleed just by thinking about it. Situated amidst China's Wuling Mountains, Feng Xing Shan, or Mount Feng Xing, is a distinctive formation of 2 tall, narrow, and lush green peaks. At the top of these peaks sits the enigmatic Feng Xing Temple. While the temple is a holy site for Buddhists, the date of its construction, along with the exact group responsible for it and how long they lived there, is unknown. Buddhism spread throughout the region during the Tang Dynasty around 639 CE, but that doesn't really narrow the construction time frame down, as that's still hundreds of years. Around 1,100 people live in the lower area around the temple, and while it's open to visitors, it's mostly occupied by caretaker monks. If you want to pay your respects, be prepared for a dizzying journey as the temple sits 8,432 feet above sea level, making it the highest point in the mountain range. To get to the top, you need to traverse a trail consisting of a glute-busting 8,000 steps, which would be the equivalent of climbing 381 floors in a standard building. And at that height, the view is certifiably magnificent. That's probably why the temple was declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 1986. As impressive as that is anyone else out of breath just thinking about it? Now, ever heard of a small town being called the Pits? Well, this next town with a giant hole in the middle is quite literally the Pit. A Russian pit, to be specific. The story of how it came to be takes us back to 1955 in the heart of what was then the Soviet Union. 3 Soviet geologists were out here hunting for kimberlite, which is a blue-tinged rock that sometimes contains trace amounts of diamonds. Instead of a few rocks, they discovered one of the largest natural diamond deposits in the Soviet Union. News quickly spread of the diamond-rich soil, which led to a small settlement called Mirny forming in the area that eventually grew into an entire town. The giant hole in the center of the town is the result of the diamond mine expanding outwards over the years. By the 1960s, Mirny was producing 10 million carats, or 4,409 pounds of diamonds per year. Unfortunately, this diamond mine dried up in 2011, leaving the locals with a great big hole to navigate. It's the second largest man-made hole in the world, measuring in at a staggering 1,722 feet deep and 3,900 feet wide. That makes it three Washington Monuments deep and 11 football fields wide. That's one serious sink. In fact, the Mirny hole is so big that there's actually some worry it's a flight risk. That's because if a hole is deep enough, and the Mirny mine is certainly deep enough, the Earth begins to warm the air inside it. As warm air rises, the hot, earthy air displaces the cooler air above the hole. It's theorized this air movement could potentially interfere with or even suck small aircraft like helicopters into the hole. But it's never been proven. So remember, kids, next time you think your town sucks, just remember Mirny. And lastly, Centralia, Pennsylvania is a humble little town nestled amidst the state's great hills. It's quite serene, but its most interesting quirk is that it's constantly on fire. It all started back in 1962 when Centralia was an unremarkable town with a trash problem. Residents were using abandoned mine pits as garbage dumps and trash was still piling up. The city council proposed removing all this garbage by burning it. Unfortunately, this trash fire burned down into an abandoned coal mine. As it turns out, Centralia was built atop an enormous deposit of natural coal seams, which the spreading fire ignited and has been burning ever since. If you're thinking, hey, the fire's underground, no big deal, you're dead wrong. Also, you should never be in charge of health and safety in any form. The underground fire is still burning to the extent that smoke literally seeps out of the ground, which contains high levels of carbon monoxide, an odorless gas that's deadly to humans. As you can imagine, being above a fiery hellscape did not prove advantageous for Centralia's infrastructure or its residents. Roads and buildings sank into the ground or outright collapsed, and as the years rolled by, more people moved away. Eventually, barricades were placed around the town to discourage anyone from visiting or driving through Centralia, as entire sections of roads sometimes vanish into smoky sinkholes. Astonishingly, however, not everyone has abandoned Centralia. When the fire began in 1962, the town boasted a population of some 3,000 people. As of the most recent census, just 5 people remain living in Centralia, making it almost, but not a complete ghost town. So why do these people stay? Maybe they enjoy the isolation or just too old and stubborn to leave. Maybe the census accidentally pulled a bunch of ghosts. Whatever the reason though, it seems Centralia will eventually become a shell of its former self before disappearing into the ground entirely. So not exactly a seller's market. Well, there you have it, a collection of truly crazy places to live. Could you ever call any of them home? Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.